Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Lori Fatchett McGee, and it is my privilege to serve as worship associate for today's service. I'm joined today by Mike Kovancic, who is serving as today's worship leader. We are also joined by Benjamin Pritchard on piano and Mark Allender, who is doing a reading for us today. We light our chalice this morning with these words from Alfred North Whitehead. Children are our immortality. In them we see the story of our life written in a fairer hand. We write our call to worship when we are serving as a worship associate. Oftentimes, the person who is serving will meet with the worship leader once or twice to get the idea of what they're going to talk about so that our call to worship matches the theme. And when I was talking to Mike about doing this service with him, I had all these thoughts in mind about what I could talk about with this call to worship. My own parenting sort of fails, my grandpa, how being a grandparent is totally different than being a parent, etc. And now what I'm going to tell you about is something totally different, because we had this wonderful conversation and I was reminded of something that completely fits what we're going to be talking about here today. When I was a little girl, about 4 or 5 years old, my parents moved to Boston. And I was the only grandchild at the time. And my grandparents were here in northeastern Ohio. So they would often fly me from Boston all by my little lonesome, because that's what you did then. I would fly from Boston to Cleveland and spend some time with them. So the first time I flew in an airplane was all by myself. And it was shortly after my favorite person in the whole world had passed away, my great-grandfather, who I called Papa Lula because he called me Lori Lula. So I was so excited for my first plane ride because everybody told me that Papa Lula was in heaven. So he was in the sky, right? Because they're pointing up to the sky. So he's up there. So I thought, yes, I'm going to get in the plane. I'm going to get through those clouds and I'm going to see him. He was not there. And I was angry. I wasn't hurt. I wasn't, upset in that way. I was really mad that everybody in my life had lied to me. Because they said that heaven was in the sky, but I couldn't see it. And I don't remember what their response to that was. I don't remember what they told me or how they fixed it or how they soothed my little girl's soul. But what I do remember is I started doubting them after that. And I wonder if that very early incident planted the seeds for my being here in this community today. Those are the stories you're going to hear today. Come, let us worship together.
Well, now that we have the kids out of the room, I can tell you the following story. Stephanie and I took Benny and one of his little buddies on an outing about a year and a half ago. It was to a local business that caters to families with young children. It's a neat design, this business. One side is a cafe. And then, on the other side, separated by noise-reducing double-pane glass, is a sort of child terrarium. It's an area where children can run around and play with wild abandon, with padded cages and sliding boards and crawling tubes, building blocks. This is an area where kids can get as crazy as they want without any danger they'll escape their confines and terrorize the local community. Parents, on the other hand, can sit in the cafe with a book or an iPhone or a laptop and every now and then gaze lovingly through the protective glass. Kind of a nature channel kind of experience where you sit calmly and in comfort and watch wild things tumble around in their natural habitat. This arrangement has all the ease of neglect without the guilt and social workers. As we approached the building, the doors burst open and a mother came out with two toddlers who were in full meltdown mode. this looks like it's going to be fun, I said to my wife. My words, however, were completely drowned out by the sound of the unrestrained children in the interior of the building. I'm trying to think of how to describe a couple dozen children in a glass enclosure and what that sounds like. The only thing I can come up with is slaughterhouse on meth. There was a relentless, full-volume blast of screaming, crying, and banging. This is when I realized that we keep society from crumbling by outnumbering our children. It's the natural order of things. We're at all times one chunky cheese away from total anarchy. Well, as a dad, I scanned the space, the play area, and I noticed that there were electrical outlets all over the place, and they didn't have those safety plugs in them. I assumed that this was that the intention of the owners was to treat these as activity areas. Children can learn about electricity through the miracle of electric shocks. There was also, I was still scanning for threats, I noticed that there was one area that was set aside for children to pummel each other with rubber objects. There were dodgeballs and rubber frisbees and, oddly enough, rubber pigs. And they were supposed to hit each other with these things. And this area had been taken over by some teenage boys who were throwing the dodgeballs with astonishing energy at the smaller kids. I dubbed this the concussion room, this play area. And it seemed wrong to me that most of the kids there were between the ages of 5 and 7, and here were these teenagers whipping these dodgeballs at them. I know the kids those ages are not well equipped to deal with random brutal violence. And they were often knocked head over heels, and they would lie silently for a moment and then get up crying and flee. Every now and then, somebody would bring them a bag of ice and interrupt their parents' internet reverie in the cafe. It occurred to me that the concussion room was designed to teach children about cruelty and injustice, which has a broader range of applications in everyday life. I was going to complain to staff, and then I looked closer and I realized that these teenagers who were throwing the dodgeballs were in uniform. This is, I think, one of the signs of the apocalypse. The bullies are now running the playground. Benny was 4 years old at the time, a really quiet, shy kid who likes introspection and organization. And here I was bringing him to what essentially looked like an exercise yard in a maximum security prison. His little friend, however, saw the play area and got a kind of faraway look in his eyes as if he gotten a glimpse of the promised land. This is a kid who'd been training his whole life for this moment. So Benny's little friend disappeared into the maelstrom like a seasoned professional while Benny hung onto my leg in terror. My wife took out a magazine, got ordered a cup of coffee, sat in the cafe, and my intention was to join her. So I escorted Benny to one of the climbing towers and I gave him an encouraging little nudge, and Benny climbed up one level and immediately found himself surrounded by a gaggle of German-fested little slobber monsters who were crashing into each other and screaming like banshees. Benny looked back and realized that I was not joining him in the trauma tower, and he fled in tears. That's when I started to feel like a bad parent. I had just paid $8.50 to dump my child in a bin of feral children so I could have coffee in peace. So I decided to stay in the play area. I felt good about this. I looked back at the other parents through the protective glass, gazing at their children. They just kind of seemed like people who were there to visit their children in a prison visitation pod. And judging by some of their children's behaviors, this may have been rehearsal for a future event. So I decided to become more of a helicopter parent that everybody hates. I escorted Benny to the toddler section, which is the most sedate corner of the play area. In that section were these big, soft vinyl blocks that you could use to build things, little houses and bridges and things. So Benny and I started building some things. It was kind of fun. But every few minutes, this one little savage child would run in and destroy whatever we were building. Later, Benny and I decided to get on the little sliding board in the toddler area, and that same little savage child burst in, and he climbed to the top of the sliding board and leered menacingly at Benny to ward him away. I don't know if you've ever read Lord of the Flies, but it did feel as if this child was trying to establish his dominance in the vinyl kingdom of construction toys. Well, Benny, being the kind of kid he is, responded by pretending not to be interested in the sliding board. Seems like a pretty valid response. Mine was not as valid. I referred the kid to the concussion room for a little street justice. Well, things got worse because Benny started to enjoy himself. He met up with his little friend. They reconnected there. And the two of them disappeared into one of the grimy, crawling tunnels. Every now and then, I could look through the chaos and get little glimpses of the two of them on sliding boards and running around. And I thought, he's learning the joy of senseless violence and chaos. It's going to take a while to integrate him back into civil society. One realization I had about that experience was that my reaction to all of that was more about me than about the play space. I thought about my own childhood, which was characterized by splintery wood, rusty nails, and fistfuls of firecrackers purchased from the local convenience store. I was going to have to learn how to embrace the padded, carpeted world of the modern play space. Next time we'll go, we will go again. I will bring a book, and I'll order a coffee.
It all began at Christmas 2 years ago when my daughter was 4 years old, and it was the first time she ever asked about what did this holiday mean. I explained to her that this was celebrating the birth of Jesus. She wanted to know more about that. We went out and bought a kid's Bible and had these readings at night. She loved them. Wanted to know everything about Jesus. So we read a lot about his birth and a lot about his teaching. She would ask constantly, what was the phrase? What was that phrase? And I would explain it to her that this was, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. We would talk about those old words, what it all meant. One day we were driving past a big church, and out front was an enormous crucifix. And she said, who is that? I guess I never really told her that part of the story. So I had to sort of, yeah, well, that's Jesus, and I forgot to tell you the ending. Because, yeah, well, you know, he ran afoul of the Roman government. You know, this message that he had was so radical and unnerving to the prevailing authorities of the time that they had to kill him. They came to the conclusion that he would have to die. And that message was too troublesome for them. It was about a month later, after that Christmas, we'd gone through the whole story of what Christmas meant. It was mid-January, and her preschool celebrates the same holidays as the local school, so Martin Luther King Day was off. I knocked off work that day. I decided we would play, and I would take her out to lunch, and we were sitting right there on the table. Where we happened to plop down was the art section of the local newspaper, and there, big as life, was a drawing by, you know, like a 10-year-old kid from the local schools of Martin Luther King. And she said, who is that? I said, well, as it happens, that is Martin Luther King. And he is why you are not in school today. We are celebrating his birthday. This is the day we celebrate his life. She said, well, who is he? I said, well, he was a preacher. And she looks up to me and says, for Jesus? I said, yeah, well, actually, yeah. But he was there for another thing that he was really famous for, which is that he had a message. You know, when you say this to a four-year-old, it's very, you know, this is the first time they ever hear anything. So you have to be careful about how you're going to phrase everything. So I said, you know, well, he was a preacher and he had this message. And she said, what was his message? I said, well, he said you should treat everybody the same, no matter what they look like. She thought about that for a minute and said, well, that's just what Jesus said. I said, well, yeah, I guess it is, you know, and never really thought about it that way. But yeah, it is sort of like do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And she thought for a minute and looked at me and said, "Did they kill him too?"
Would you please join me now in the spirit of prayer or meditation, as is your practice? This prayer comes from Rudolf W. Nemser. The friendship we share this day is sacred. All gatherings when people meet and touch celebrate life. The laughter we share this day is sacred. Joy and sorrow that rise from love are springs of life. The stillness we share this day is sacred. In this peace is a haven for the spirit that nurtures life. For friends, for joy and sorrow, for the comfort of quietness, let us be grateful and caring. Amen, and blessed be.
Well, it's always nice when somebody with some knowledge and experience can get up and talk to us about how to parent well. And I want to wish all of you luck in finding someone who can do that for you. Not that person. This is not one of those moments where a guru strolls in and gives you enlightened and condescending advice on how to live your lives. This is more of, I'm trying to think of the technical term for it, cry of desperation. That's the way to describe it. The story I shared earlier kind of might help to show that I'm probably not perfect in my parenting. I realize also that our topic is on spiritual parenting, and not everybody here is a parent. But I do assume that at least most of you are the result of some sort of transaction between a male and a female. I know you have to be careful what you assume in a UU church. So half of you might be holograms or the products of 3D printing technology. I'm just going to do the best I can. A few of you, I see some hands coming up. I know. I'm just going to do the best I can with that. There are challenges to being a parent. Although I saw a book title just the other day, "Parenting is Easy, You're Probably Just Doing It Wrong." Everyone I know, however, who has children talks about the struggles of it. In fact, I meet with a group here at the church of people with children, and we kind of share our experiences and things, and I ask them to talk about some of the struggles they've had, and here are some of the quotes I got from them, some of the hardships of being a parent. Being the adult when you want to be the kid. You have to stand up and be a good parent when you don't actually have the energy to stand at all. Struggling to deal with public outbursts and knowing that everyone is judging you. Well, I'm a therapist, and a lot of my day is spent with trauma work. So one of my challenges as a parent is that I go hour after hour hearing these trauma stories. Those clients need and deserve my complete attention, engagement, and competence. But I'm also a supervisor, so in between every client, as I open the door to let the client out, there are people standing in the hallway who want to consult with me on difficult cases, and those people deserve my complete engagement, attention, and competence. And then I come home from work, and the baby wants to be held, and my son wants to tell me every thought he had since the last time he saw me. And they need and deserve my complete attention and engagement and competence. But it often feels that I am doing too many things for too many people too much of the time. It seems as if people want to interact with me every single minute of every single day. And I have to tell you, honestly, I'm not that wonderful. I'm an introvert, and if I don't get a certain amount of time to myself, I feel completely insane. I often suspect that parenting asks more of us than any of us is really capable of providing. One of the struggles I have is I have very sensitive hearing, which has been wonderful in my work as a musician. But holding a crying baby is really like somebody pounding nails straight into my skull. In developing this service, I was spit up on 25 times. I had to change a few dozen diapers. I had to answer about 15 questions about the meaning of life, and I had to deal with 12 meltdowns that were either about pajamas or snack food. The way I cope with this is I get up really early in the morning, and I tiptoe around like a cat burglar in my own house. try not to wake up the circus. Doesn't work that well, the circus wakes up. My other technique is to set the kids up with things to play with nearby, and I try to zone out on some of my creative projects with them right there near me. I know this isn't imperfect because my son Benny, he's 5 years old now, will often play near me and say like, "Daddy, look at this toy. Look at this dance I'm doing. Hey, look at this." And after a while, I start not looking and I just go, yeah, that's great. He's behind me. I'm going, yeah, how cool, Benny. Thanks for showing me that. And Benny will pause and say, "Daddy, look with your eyes." It's pretty heavy, isn't it? Feel like a good dad in that moment? No, not so much. There's also this contraption. It's a saucer thing, and it's got a harness in the middle that you put your baby in, and it's got toys all around the perimeter, so the baby can just kind of bat around at the toys. I call it the neglect around. What I found, and this is one of those moments when I have to question myself, as I'm lowering our baby Katie into this, the look of disappointment on her face. She doesn't have too many words yet, but I know she's thinking, this is really the best you can do. This is it. Another experience I had was now Katie's starting to crawl, so we take her out of the neglect around and let her crawl around. And just the other day, I went to check on her and she was chewing on something. Now, I didn't give her any food. I said, "What are you chewing on?" I fished something out of her mouth. It was half a stink bug. As far as I can tell, the other half was working its way down her digestive tract. Part of me thought, what a horrible parent I am that I missed this, didn't catch this earlier. The other part of me thought, it's an economical way to get rid of stink bugs. The other issue I have that when I realize that I may not be totally on my game is sometimes Benny and I be playing some kind of pretend game together. And we'll both be really getting into it. And then this happens every time. He'll start to get kind of a concerned look on his face. And he'll say to me, "You know we're just pretending, right?" And I say to, and it occurs, and I go like, okay. Got it. It occurs to me that I'm supposed to be his anchor in reality, and I'm not a very good anchor. There are moments in parenting when everything is working and you feel like super parent, and there are moments where things are going horribly wrong and absolutely everything you do to try to manage it makes it worse. I call this the chutes and ladders of the soul. But this is also where spirituality enters that picture. I think that religion is about trying to come to terms with those things in the universe that are uncontrollable. What better way to describe parenthood? I went online when I proposed this topic, looking for books on the topic of spiritual parenting. And I found loads and loads and loads of books by right-wing writers about how to raise your children to be good conservative Christians. Each one of them cherry-picked various passages from the Bible. I'm a little nervous about using the Bible as a parenting guide. Exodus 21:17, "And he that curseth his father and mother shall surely be put to death." If you follow biblical parenting advice to its letter, you will be a resident of a federal prison system in no time. It's interesting where the disconnect might be. And I think that part of it is that virtually all of the great prophets through history and of all the significant religions were people who did not have children. Did you ever notice that? You know, Jesus Christ had all these beautiful and compassionate statements like, "Let he who is without sin cast the first stone." It's brilliant, powerful stuff. If he was a parent, he might have been known for quotes like, "Stop crying or I'll give you something to cry about." Or, "If you kids don't settle down, I'm turning this cart around and we're going back to Nazareth." But a friend of mine did some work in the Peace Corps, and she told a story that I think answers this issue. She did some volunteer work in a third world country, and on her last day, people were throwing a party and giving her presents to thank her. And a little boy gave her a shell. And she knew, from being familiar with the area, that to get that shell, that boy would have had to walk 2 days through rough terrain to get to the shoreline to find a shell. And she said to him, "You've had a long walk." And the boy said, "Long walk is part of the gift." And that's what I think parenting is. It's the long walk we take, but it's to get. It's not just for the gift, but to give and receive gift. It's the lot we get in return because children connect us to the divine. They have a direct line to God that we as adults don't always see. In Buddhism, there's a concept of the new mind. It's the idea of experiencing the world as if you're seeing it for the first time and having a pure experience instead of a pre-decided experience with life. It's something to work hard for, and it comes naturally to children. There are times when Benny will pick up a leaf and look at it with awe, and he'll show it to me, and I'll realize, that's pretty amazing. It is amazing. He's right. How often do we step over a miracle to get to the next hassle? And when Benny says, look with your eyes, I think he's talking about mindfulness, reminding us to be here now. I heard a minister one time who said that in their religious education class, a little girl was drawing a picture, and they said, what are you drawing? And she said, I'm drawing a picture of God. And her teacher said, well, no, sweetheart, nobody knows what God looks like. The little girl said, give me a minute to finish and you'll find out. And Benny and I have been having these amazing conversations about spiritual concepts. Stephanie got him a couple of children's Bibles. I was honestly kind of nervous about that idea. But as we started reading them together, a couple interesting things have emerged. And one of them was when we were reading the story about Abraham, where God asks Abraham to sacrifice his only son. I read that passage and Benny said, no, you read that wrong. God would never ask someone to sacrifice their only son. So I read the passage again. And Benny said, you read it wrong again. And I said, so how about we read some Beatrix Potter? Yeah, read about some rabbits or something. Another spiritual moment for me in parenting was when I was asking Benny to do something, and he said, why is it that I have to listen to you? I decided that this was an important enough question that I should pull out the nuclear option, and I said, you have to listen to me because I made you. And this didn't have the effect I thought. I thought it would have be in silence and awe or something. He kind of smirked and said, you didn't make me. God made me. All right. Well, I said, okay, but I helped. I said, look, I put 10 minutes worth of work into creating you, and I expect to get credit for that. And Benny said, silly daddy. So there are those mistakes we make as parents and those moments when things just aren't working. But I think that perfection is the enemy of the good, that when we try to be perfect, we've already failed before we've started. Often when I'm meeting with clients and they're talking about their struggles as parents, I point out that the good parents aren't the ones who are perfect. It's the ones who are always asking, can I do better? Am I doing okay? That's the hallmark of a good parent. And think about the sacred role of parenting. Children, whether they know it or not, are engaged all the time in the task of trying to learn how to make sense of the world and how to act on the world in order to survive. Peggy O'Mara once said, the way we talk to our children becomes their inner voice. Have you ever had that experience? Hear your parents in your head? Anytime I call in sick from work, I hear my dad go, lazy. Right? We're shaped by these experiences. We're so shaped by these experiences that I heard a talk by a doctor who runs a hospice. And he said the most important room in our hospice is the kitchen, which might seem odd because the people there are almost all too sick to eat food. But they use the kitchen to create a sensory experience that would be powerful and moving to the residents. And you know what that is? The smell of baking cookies. The smell of baking cookies. In those moments, that oven becomes a time machine back to everyone's childhood, to that moment of anticipation and joy. That's how powerful these symbols are. They tie us to our childhood. Well, back to talking about our group of parents who meet here at the church, I asked them to share some of the spiritual experiences they've had with parenting. One person said, feeling overwhelmingly connected to the spirit of love. Holding a life in my hands that I helped create. Knowing that I'm contributing positively to the universe by bringing a person into this world who is full of love and kindness. That moment when my child rests his head on my chest and the rest of life's problems seem silly. And looking back, being a parent shapes our experiences in remembering our own parent, being parented. Nothing promotes forgiveness of our parents than becoming parents. And even in the cases where there were abusive parents, absent parents, adoptive parents, in so many cases it's not, when I say parents, I may be talking about somebody who raised a child who isn't biologically the parent. The challenge is to pass on the kindness we got from that and to rise above the mistakes and the hardships. It's important to let go of our resentments because it makes us better parents. And what a powerful, sacred role it is to shape the future. Mahatma Gandhi said, "The future depends on what we do in the present." This doesn't mean that we come up with a rigid plan of how the world should work and then demand that it go that way. We have to let go of preconceptions. John Wilmot, the Earl of Rochester, one time said, "Before I was married, I had 6 theories about raising children. Now I have 6 children and no theories." But there's a famous poem, maybe some of you have heard, called "Welcome to Holland." It's a poem written for parents of handicapped children. It tells a little story. The story goes like this. Imagine that you decide you want to go to Italy. And you spend years planning it. You learn a bit of the language. You read up on the history and the architecture and the food. And you're so excited. You're flying there. And it's kind of a rough flight. And when you land, somebody gets on the intercom and says, "We've had some mechanical problems. We couldn't get you to your destination. Welcome to Holland." And your experience in Holland is profoundly shaped by how quickly you let go of the, "This isn't Italy. This isn't Italian food. These people aren't speaking Italian." But when you embrace what is instead of what you had planned for things to be. And I think that's a good analogy to parenthood, of how much we have to let go of that we thought parenting was, or who we thought we were. It's the idea of, instead of having a rigid plan, having a series of strategies. One example of this, imagine you've got 2 people who need to climb a mountain. I'm not sure why you'd need to climb a mountain, but let's imagine you do. There could be one person who has a very detailed map that shows how to get to the top of that mountain. That person probably won't go too far before they encounter something that's flooded or collapsed, something that no longer matches the map. That person comes to a dead stop, can't go any further, because their map is now telling them how to do things on a landscape that doesn't match the real world. But imagine if the second person has to climb that mountain, and they are equipped with numerous strategies to keep going up. Climb over things, climb around things, find a way over and through. It's the difference between dogma and critical thinking, which is the root of this church. It's the difference between MapQuest and GPS. And a lot of the spiritual experience of being a parent is coming to terms with the beginnings and endings. Our son Paul passed away in 2010, and our son Benny was born almost exactly a year later. When Benny was really still little and was just learning to speak, he had probably about 50 words that he could use. He crawled, snuggled into bed with us, and he said to us, "Paul is hiding." And it occurred to me how sad it is that he was imagining that his brother would wake up every morning and hide from him and choose not to be with him. How heartbreaking that is. So he said, no, Paul is not hiding. He passed away. He had to leave. There was a problem. I'm trying to, take these 50 words and describe complex ideas about life and death and the universe. So he said Paul had to go away. And Benny thought about that for a moment. In a tiny voice then, he said, "Well, I have to go away." How do you answer that with those 50 words? And I'll tell you that probably a third of those words are words we used to describe our cats. This parenting stuff is harder than algebra, ladies and gentlemen. The spiritual moments are not the ones we plan. It's ones like this that fall into our lap. I recently read a book by Andrew Solomon called Far From the Tree. And it's about parenting under difficult circumstances. And he reached a really moving conclusion. He said, "If some glorious angel descended into my living room and offered to exchange my children for other, better children, brighter, kinder, funnier, more loving, more disciplined, more accomplished, I would clutch the ones I have and, like most parents, pray away the atrocious specter." Welcome to Holland. Well, in conclusion, I don't like to give advice. I don't feel I'm in a position to do that. But I'll share some of the meaningful ideas that I care for and am fond of. One of them is, look with your eyes. And the other, no matter what hardships and setups and failures, keep going up. Amen. This is a quote from Frederick Douglass. Please excuse the gender bias. "It's easier to build strong children than to repair broken men. Go in peace."